Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to another edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me as always is Jasmine Smith. Hello, Jasmine. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Robert?
I'm doing well. Today on the show, we're going to be talking about criminal justice reform. We're going to be talking about education, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the new war on Louisville. We're catching up on some stuff we talked about in previous shows. It'll be really exciting, and we're glad that you're here with us. So without any further ado, let's get started. All right, Jasmine, it is February in the state of Kentucky, and we shouldn't all have allergies, but it's warm, and we all do. We're going to do our best, but I think we were talking before the show, and we both feel about 4 out of 10.
Right, we both rated our health at a solid 4.
So we're going to persevere, and we're going to get through this. We're going to tell you all you need to know about important stuff. Jasmine, tell us all about criminal justice reform.
Okay, so this is pretty exciting for me because this is an issue that I really care about. So why do we need criminal justice reform? Well, as of November 2016, Kentucky had over 23,000 of its citizens imprisoned, which is up sevenfold since the early 1970s when we incarcerated fewer than 3,000. So that's a huge, huge increase in the number of people incarcerated, but the crime rate has remained the same. So there hasn't been an increase in the crime rate, but a huge increase in the imprisonment population. So defendants are sitting in jail on minor offenses with high bonds, receiving no bail credit. We have overcrowded jails. If you live in Louisville, I'm sure you've heard about this over the past few months. Louisville Metro Department of Corrections literally has people sleeping on floors. They had to open up an old jail building that violates fire code, so they were housing inmates in a building that's not up to fire code. It's a mess over there. People are being held when they shouldn't be. It's all kind of a mess. And also the penal code is a bit of a mess, and so that's why we need criminal justice reform. Going back a little bit, back in 2011, House Bill 463 was signed into law with the promise of significantly reducing the level of incarceration, but it hasn't really done that. It's just kind of flatlined it. And part of that is because judges and prosecutors have been reluctant to enforce provisions of it. One example is bail credit. Bail credit is supposed to be given unless a defendant is a danger or a flight risk, but less than 2% of people in jail aren't receiving bail credit. So bail credit is supposed to be like you're getting $100 a day towards your bail, but most defendants are not getting that. It's denied in 98%.
And there was a court case around that, wasn't there, at some point recently?
Yes. The Louisville Public Defender's Office filed motions regarding bail credit. Nothing's changed since then, though. So people are still being denied bail credit. And another provision of House Bill 463 that hasn't really had an effect as deferred prosecution, which would defer prosecution for like drug offenses if clients got treatment, stayed out of trouble, those kind of things. House Bill 463 didn't really accomplish what it was supposed to accomplish. And what also happened was that more inmates that were serving state sentences were serving them in county jails, which are, like I said, insanely overcrowded, and they have little to no programming. So by programming, I mean treatment programs.
And that's supposed to reduce recidivism, right?
Right. And because there are people actually serving their prison sentences in the county jail, they're not receiving drug treatment, alcohol treatment, or any kind of reentry preparation. They're sleeping on floors and being housed in buildings that violate fire code. Fast forward to summer of 2016, Matt Bevin created the Criminal Justice Policy Assessment Council, which is a 23-member bipartisan panel that was going to seek advice and study evidence regarding criminal justice reform and try to come up with a new bill. And so this panel included ministers, prosecutors, DPA, that's the Department of Public Advocacy, their deputy advocate Damon Preston, State Senator Whitney Westerfield, Representative Daryl Owens, who sponsored the felony expungement bill that allows for some Class D felonies to be expunged, Senator Morgan McGarvey of Louisville, and Justice Venters of the Kentucky Supreme Court. So those are just some of the notable people on that council. But who's missing? An organization called the Kentucky Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and they have no representation on that council. So there's one person from DPA, Damon Preston, but no one from the KACDL was on the panel.
The KACDL is the Kentucky Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
Yes. Right. Okay. So even still, they felt, you know, like they weren't represented, but they were still hopeful about what the panel would do. There was talk of several issues that would be addressed by this panel and that would be part of some bill this legislative session. And those things included reclassifying some felonies as misdemeanors, raising dollar amounts on like felony theft and child support. So right now, any kind of like theft or receipt of stolen property over $500 is a felony. There was talk of increasing that dollar amount and also increasing the dollar amount on felony child support offenses. Also, alternative sentencing options for nonviolent offenders, and that might mean like treatment programs or like day reporting programs, something to avoid imprisonment. Sentencing reform is another thing that people were hopeful would be addressed, particularly mandatory minimums for PFOs. Do you know what a PFO is, Robert?
Not a clue. What is a PFO?
Okay, so there's a statute called the Persistent Felony Offender Statute. That's the PFO statute. And what that requires is enhanced punishment for people with a prior felony. And there's a lot more to the statute, but we're not talking about adding on a few months or a year to a sentence because of a prior felony. We're talking about doubling sentences because of a prior felony. So people were hoping that there would be some sentencing reform included in a criminal justice reform bill, and also maybe reforming parts of the penal code. Because like I said, it was written and then lots of things were added, and it's a little bit of a mess, honestly. So what did the Criminal Justice Policy Assessment Council come up with? They came up with Senate Bill 120, and that's been sponsored by Senator Whitney Westerfeld. It is supposed to reduce recidivism by creating options for rehabilitation. And so here are some of the things that it will do. It will prevent people from automatically getting disqualified from obtaining an occupational license because of a prior conviction. So this is a really good thing.
Right. So before, people, if you've been released from prison, you couldn't become like a barber or like a nail, like that kind of stuff. Is that like...
It keeps there from being an automatic ban from applying for some kind of professional license. Okay. And the bill includes all kinds of different licenses.
So there used to be like an automatic ban, and you would have to like try to get out of it. Now that would just not be there. You could then just go get an occupational license no matter what.
I'm not sure that you could get an occupational license no matter what, but there's no automatic ban
right,
anymore.
I gotcha.
Okay. There'd also be a pilot program to require people on parole who struggle with substance abuse to attend therapy sessions and take other steps to overcome their addiction. So that provision would require the Department of Corrections to like set up this pilot program.
Right, right.
Another one is private companies would be able to set up factories in prisons, and inmates would be paid at least federal minimum wage. But of course, earnings could be deducted for things like taxes and child support. So what this reminded me of is if you've watched Orange is the New Black,
right,
where they have the panty company and they're like sewing underwear.
Okay.
So that would allow like a private company to have a factory in a prison.
Right.
And provide jobs.
And this was a big deal when they passed that law in 2011, was that there were a lot of people that were in prison for child support stuff, and there was no way to get out of it because you're in prison.
They can't hold you in contempt for not paying while you're incarcerated, but you may have a lot of arrears once you get out. So the bill would also create compliance credits for people on parole. So this is like earning credit for good behavior. It could cut some time off one's parole if they are substantially compliant with the terms of their parole. It would also allow jails to operate day reporting centers, and funding would be tied to how successful they are at reducing recidivism. So a day reporting center would be like you'd be released from jail, maybe on some kind of house arrest, home incarceration, something like that, and then have to report every day. A lot of times these day reporting centers, they drug test, they help with jobs, you have work release while you're doing that. So this would allow jails to operate those kind of centers. It also creates something called the Angel Initiative, which means that if someone comes to the police department asking for help with an addiction, they can be screened for placement in a treatment facility. So that sounds like a good thing.
Right.
And then there are some other things. You know, this one, there would actually be an increase in detention time for probation and parole violations. So that's an increase in incarceration time. I don't really like that provision.
Sure.
But so those are the main things that Senate Bill 120 sets out to do.
Uh-huh.
Matt Bevin said in a quote, "The purpose of criminal justice is to rehabilitate and reassimilate people, not to simply remove them. but we're still removing them. This bill doesn't really do anything to address bail, mandatory minimums, sentencing reform, classification of felonies and misdemeanors, all of those things that I talked about earlier that people were really hopeful that would be addressed by this council. We're still removing people and putting them in jail and in prison. What this bill kind of does is helps them once they're there.
Right.
Amy Hanna, who's the president of the Kentucky Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, wrote a really great opinion piece in the Career Journal, so I suggest that everyone read that. I linked it in our show notes, and so she really explained this really well, but this bill doesn't do enough. I think it's good. I think all of these things, most of these things, I think most of them are good things. You know, it's going to create reentry programs. It sounds like it's supposed to create more drug treatment programs.
Sure.
But I don't think it goes far enough. This is not the criminal justice reform that people expected. I think they're positive, but it still fails to address a lot of major problems. And I don't think it fixes the problems that we have now.
Right.
It doesn't do anything to reduce how many people are going to be incarcerated. It helps them once they're there. But, you know, hopefully we can expect a decline in incarceration rates later after these people are released from prison, because what it sets to do is
reduce recidivism,
put things in place for reentry, job training programs, educational programs, compliance credits for parole, for good behavior, things like that. So hopefully it reduces recidivism later, but it doesn't really do a lot to address the problems that we have right now. Related to this, there is also a juvenile justice bill that was proposed by Whitney Westerfeld as well that's also been just totally gutted. It created a criminal responsibility provision that a child under the age of 11 like wouldn't be held criminally responsible.
Right.
There was also a provision about transfer and waiving cases to circuit court. So what that means is trying juveniles as adults. So
right.
Juveniles are typically tried in juvenile court, which is a confidential proceeding. It has a lot of protections. It is geared towards treatment and rehabilitation. But there are certainly crimes that juveniles can be charged as adults. And this bill that was introduced would make automatic transfer laws. So there's a law that says that any child that's 14 who there's probable cause that they committed a felony and that a gun was involved in the commission of the felony, after finding probable cause, that case is automatically transferred to for the child to be tried as a youthful offender in circuit court, which is essentially being tried as an adult. So that's an pretty automatic statute. If a child who's 14 years old was at a scene of a robbery, didn't even have the gun, maybe they waited in the car, or maybe they were found with some of the property on them later, but wasn't even alleged to have had the gun. If the gun was there, that child gets tried as an adult.
Right. So this has been added to that bill?
This is the law currently.
Okay.
What that bill would do would make sending that case to circuit court discretionary. After a finding of probable cause, they would be entitled to a hearing where the judge would have to hear factors about the seriousness of the offense, the child's role in it, what their prior record looks like, what kind of services they have in place, what that child's involved in the community. It would look at that child's life and look at whether he or she can be treated, rehabilitated, and it would give the judge more discretion before sending a 14-year-old kid to be tried as an adult.
But that law, that bill
and,
is not,
and so those right. provisions, I think, are gone now.
Right.
And what remains of that bill is mostly, like, data collection.
Right.
I don't think these bills go far enough.
Right. So that's kind of interesting. So, you know, we have this bill, SB 120, that you've been talking about, that has a lot of these reforms in place that were put in place. And you made a good point. I mean, you've made the case, I think, that, you know, there's a lot of stuff that this bill should have done that it didn't do. But this juvenile justice bill that maybe it doesn't seem like it was all that arduous either, but it was gutted, right? So from a political standpoint, just given the legislature that we have, what's the political reality that we're living in? Is it possible to have this kind of reform with this legislature? Or, I mean, Whitney Westerfeld's a Republican, right?
Right. I'm not sure that it is. I think that people were hopeful that criminal justice reform would be this bipartisan effort, especially since we passed the felony expungement bill.
Right.
That was passed before we had the new supermajority in the House, but it had bipartisan support. Matt Bevin has talked about criminal justice reform and felon voting rights, but he hasn't done any of that.
Yeah, so it's kind of like it's one thing to say stuff, and right. then when the rubber actually hits the road, it's a lot different.
But in the juvenile justice provisions, particularly the waiver and transfer to circuit court, I don't see that ever passing with the House and Senate that we have now. The criminal responsibility provision, maybe I had hope for that one, but sentencing reform, waiver and transfer for juveniles, those kind of things, I don't see them passing. And I think that's why these bills have been watered down,
right?
And make small changes and add some programming and those kind of things. But I don't think we will get the reform that people were hoping for
until
with
we get
this legislature.
Yeah, until we get a more liberal legislature. The fact that they're doing something about it, even though we're having the legislature that we have now, I mean, that could be
right.
good.
This is a positive bill. I'm not saying that it's a bad thing. It's positive, but it's watered down.
Right.
And it's been gutted, basically.
So, yeah. So at the end of the day, Jasmine says she supports it, but wishes it had done more.
Right.
Right. All right. There you go. All right, Jasmine, let's talk a little bit about education. We've talked about education in the past couple of shows, but there's been a lot that's happened. So we got to catch everybody up. All right. So we talked about Senate Bill 1. Was that just last week? It was. It was just last show that we talked about Senate Bill 1, the Senate bill that addresses education, K-12 education. It has now passed the Senate. It hasn't yet been referred to a House committee, but it probably will be soon. So KEA, which is Kentucky Educators Association, that's the teachers union, they said that they were encouraged that Senator Wilson had been very collaborative in writing the bill. That bill ended up actually passing the Senate 35-0. Everybody kind of voted for it. I guess Republicans and Democrats alike, they appreciated all the work that Senator Wilson put into it. You know, we're going to have something different. I would suggest everybody go listen to our show about Senate Bill 1 to hear both the pros and cons to the approach that the legislature is taking to it. But I think given that it was pretty clear that reform was going to occur, Senator Wilson did a good job of making sure that it wasn't as divisive as some of the other items in the legislature this year have been. That's not all that happened in education, though. Senator Bam Carney, a Republican from Campbellsville, he filed a new bill about charter schools. He is a House member, and he is the chair of the House Education Committee, so this is an important bill. So there had already been two bills that were filed about charters. One by Gerald Neal, who's a Democrat in Louisville, which was a pilot program in Louisville and Lexington, and a different plan by Phil Moffitt, who's also a Republican from Louisville, which was a statewide bill. I believe we talked a little bit earlier about how the liberals were kind of trying to pilot it so it would be smaller. Republicans wanted
They knew it was going to happen, so they're like, why don't we just kind of ease into this thing?
Right, and then Phil Moffitt was like, no, statewide, everything can go. Then Bam Carney stepped in, and he's kind of split the difference a little bit. Okay, so let me take a step backwards. Phil Moffitt's bill was a statewide bill, and it allowed mayors, school districts, public and non-public four-year post-secondary education institutions, the Kentucky Council on Post-Secondary Education, and the State Board of Education to create charter schools. So all of those,
like anybody,
pretty much
anybody.
Yeah, and the one that people were very concerned about were the non-public four-year right. institutions, which could be any like University of Phoenix and stuff like
right,
that.
Private.
So I mean, obviously, you're probably starting by thinking about like Center and Bellarmine and some of the smaller Catholic or Christian schools that would want to set up their own academies. But then you get into the for-profit institutions and such that would start causing a lot of problems. Regardless, Chairman Carney, the new bill, his bill creates a statewide program, so it is statewide, but only local school boards can review and approve charter applications. So it has to go through the local school board. Representative Carney, he actually works for Taylor County Schools as an administrator, so he cares about education, works in education. And yeah, so this bill does seem like it's an attempt to compromise between the two positions that we've laid out before. And being filed by a committee chair, it's almost certain to get a hearing, but we are a little bit coming up against the clock. We only have 30 legislative days. I haven't counted them, but we've used a bunch of them. At the same time, charter schools have been an important part of this session, so it's likely that something's going to get done, and it does start to look like this will be it. So there's a lot of stuff to like. If you like charter schools, if you don't like charter schools, it could have been worse.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it, I guess.
So, you know, there is actually, I'll link this. There is a very interesting article in the New York Times this morning about charter schools and a lot of some new research that's been done into them that shows that charter schools are worse than public schools, that are actually much worse in terms of outcomes than public schools. Of course, a lot of other evidence has been mixed. Interesting stuff for sure. So that's a big issue, but not the only issue surrounding education. Jasmine, we've been talking a lot about K through 12 education, but it's about time we go to college. We're gonna go to college. Senate Bill 153, funding for post-secondary education. In terms of funding for post-secondary education, Kentucky is among the worst nationally. Did you know that?
No.
We are. Yes.
I figured. I could have guessed that, but I didn't know for sure.
So only three states. Okay, so of course, during the recession, 2009 and a little bit thereafter, 2008, 2009, and a little bit thereafter, most states cut funding to post-secondary education to make ends meet in their state budgets. But after the recession was over, only three states have continued to cut, and those are Arkansas, Vermont, and Kentucky. And Kentucky, last year, it cut funding further, and it will continue to cut further. Well, there's expected to be a 4.5% cut over the next 2 years, each of the next 2 years, I believe. So it was going to total of 9% cut over the next 2 years from post-secondary education, despite the fact that most other states have continued to increase funding to post-secondary education. But that's not really what we're talking about. In the meantime, Senator David Givens, who's a Republican from Greensburg, he introduced Senate Bill 153, which would create a competitive environment for post-secondary education funding.
So what does that mean? What is a competitive environment?
Okay. Basically, what a competitive environment means is that there's a framework, there's goals that each school has to meet, and if you do better than the other schools in them, you get more money. If you do better than the other public schools, and of course they weight them, if you do better than the other schools, you get more money, and if you do worse, you get less. So Ashley Spaulding of KSEP wrote several pieces about this bill this week. She does a good job of explaining it, but Senate Bill 153 creates a separate competitive environment. So there's one domain that's four-year universities and another for community colleges. And in the pieces that Ms. Spaulding writes, she goes more in depth into analyzing the actual framework, but there's two major points to give about this scheme. So there first is that there's no new money. Typically, when these types of things are introduced in states, there's new money that's introduced. So you get a baseline of funding that you have gotten in the past, and they're like, okay, and we're going to make this large pot of money available.
Right.
But it's going to...
And if you do well,
and if you,
you
do
can
well,
get
you
the
get
extra.
More of it. Yeah, exactly. But not this. This is to say you won't get what you got before unless you do well on it. So that's kind of scary for some people. And the second thing is that the framework is all about performance. And it does make some adjustments for preparation of students, the preparation of students who arrive at school. So if you're dealing with a bunch of kids who come to your school who aren't necessarily as prepared for college as others, it does adjust for that. But this type of framework has been studied before, and it shows that low-income and minority students typically suffer under these types of performance-based funding schemes because the schools are incentivized to only admit students they know are going to perform well. You know, if your funding is determined by the number of degrees that you print, you know, you're going to have students that can finish the classes. You can almost guarantee it. And you're not going to admit students who are more marginal. And that's been shown to really hurt low-income and minority students. So there are some problems with this type of funding scheme. But, of course, if you want schools to perform and you want to incentivize certain things, a performance-based scheme is certainly a way to accomplish that goal. Regardless, Senate Bill 153 did pass 12-1 out of the Appropriations and Revenue Committee, and it is likely headed to the Senate floor to be passed soon. If it hasn't been already, I didn't check the news today. So, yeah, that's the education piece that we wanted to talk about. We got post-secondary education, we got charter schools, and we got K through 12 curriculum setting. Jasmine, how about that? Lots of education stuff.
I feel like it's kind of sad we never really get to, like, debate, like, oh, is this gonna pass? Do you think it's gonna pass? There's never, like,
there's no drama.
A guess.
Yes.
It's just like, oh, yep, it's passing.
It's likely going to pass. Yes, almost all of this. Okay, we talked a little bit last week, Jasmine, about the urban rural divide in Kentucky and the United States as a whole. Do you remember talking about that?
I do remember.
What have people been calling it?
The war on Louisville.
The war on Louisville. Oh my goodness. So we're going to talk a little bit about that this week again. So this week in the legislature, the war on Louisville continues. The House of Representatives passed HB 246, which overturns Louisville's ban on the use of plastic bags to collect yard waste. Did you know that that was banned?
Only from reading about this.
Yes. As a homeowner, I can tell you, you do have to indeed buy The big paper ones. Yes, this house will continue to do that even if the plastic bag ban is rescinded. But it is one way in which Republicans, and some of these people that sponsored this bill were Republicans that have served in Metro Council that did not support this ordinance when it was going through, and they have now been moved to Frankfort and are going to likely have the last laugh here by making it so that Louisville can use plastic bags to collect their yard waste and, yeah, I guess sit in a landfill forever and never, you know, biodegrade. So whatever, that's a thing that's happening. And then also, that's not the only piece of the war on Louisville that got some play this week. The Senate moved Senate Bill 222 out of committee, which is the Senate version of the House bill we talked about last week. So we talked a little bit last week about this bill that would completely reorganize Louisville's government by, you know, one of the things we said, it would reduce the number of terms that a mayor can serve from 3 to 2, and it did a bunch of other stuff. So Senate Bill 222 is actually less aggressive than the House version. It doesn't do that. It doesn't reduce the term limits of a mayor from 3 to 2, but it would allow the Metro Council's political caucuses to hire and fire their own staff. So previously, these people had been, you know, staff of the individual political parties. Now these political staff would be hired by the Metro Council themselves. The mayor, Mayor Fisher, and Councilman Bill Hollander made the trip to Frankfort to speak out against this bill.
I think he's my councilman.
Yeah, I think he is too. Yes, he's District 9. He is the majority caucus chair there in the Metro Council. So they, plus Senator Morgan McGarvey and Denise Harper Angel, who are Democrats from Louisville in the Senate, they begged for the committee, the local government committee, to slow this process down. But regardless, it did pass out of committee 6-3 with one abstention. One thing that is a little bit interesting, Jasmine, Councilman David James, a Democrat from Louisville, was there speaking out in support of the bill.
Which was surprising, right?
Yes, it was surprising. It was surprising to me. We saw him speak in the New Kentucky Project. Yeah, and he, in my opinion, is gearing up for a mayoral campaign in the primary to run against Mayor Fisher. So we'll see what happens. That's something I think he's positioning himself as the alternative to Mayor Fisher in Louisville. So we'll see what happens politically there. But yes, the war on Louisville.
It's on.
It is on. All right, Jasmine, we are ready for some quick hits. Are you ready for some quick hits?
Go for it.
All right, let's hit these things quickly. Okay, so there was a very interesting pair of legislators that filed a very interesting bill. So Representative Joni Jenkins, who is a Democrat from Shively, real cool lady from Jefferson County, and Speaker Jeff Hoover, a Republican from Jamestown. They are, you know, they don't...
not on the same side.
They're not on the same side on many issues. They filed House Bill 330 together, which would extend the TIF district around the Yum Center for 20 years to up to 45 years. We talked about the Yum Center at length.
The TIF, I remember talking about that.
Yes, the TIF is the way that the state government funds the Yum Center. There's three major partners that go into funding it: the Metro Louisville, the state government, and the University of Louisville. The mayor was allowed by the Metro Council to begin negotiations around the Yum Center, and this looks like a piece of that process. We don't know for sure because these negotiations are probably not happening where we can see them, but it does look like that the state government has come to the table with something. And if the state government and UofL come to the table, Metro Louisville has basically said they will give the maximum amount that they're allowed to give under the lease for the foreseeable future. So working very hard to shore up the Yum Center's finances before this big audit of the Yum Center comes through. And this looks like a step to doing that. And then the last quick hit that we have, Jasmine, Mayor Bevin paid his taxes.
All right.
Did you hear about this?
No, I didn't.
The governor, Governor Matt Bevin, he had an overdue property tax bill.
I heard that they were overdue. Yes. hadn't heard that he paid them.
They were overdue, and if they get overdue by a certain amount, you can actually buy them on the secondary market. Though, right. You know, nobody's going to have the opportunity to buy Governor Bevin's overdue property taxes and charge him interest.
But, I once worked for a summer for a law firm that did like tax lien stuff, and so I dove into that for like 2 months.
Well, you know what? Those people, they could not put a lien on Governor Bevin's property. So, Jasmine, that's it for this week.
How Look can people at us. Giving credit where credit's due.
There you go. That's what we do. So, Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at MyOldKYPod. We have a Facebook page, My Old Kentucky Podcast, and you can like our page. You can find our show notes on Medium, and you can find our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, just about any podcasting app that you'd like to use.
All right. We will see you guys next week.